Wally.
If you had the chance to change your fate, would you?
Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's up with all the voices?
Well, our geek history lesson on Pixar is today, so get ready because your geek history lesson on the entirety of Pixar is now in session. Welcome to Geek History Lesson. I'm Ashley Victoria Robinson.
And I'm Jason Computer Generated Inman. Welcome to your mind university that sometimes might be built out of a computer and you won't even realize it, because Geek History Lesson is the podcast where we take a character or construct from pop culture and we explain it to you in about an hour.
Mm-hmm.
But today is a Geek History Lesson that is different from every other Geek History Lesson ever in all 118 episodes of the show. Why is that, Ashley?
Well, this is our first non-fiction Geek History Lesson.
Exactly right, because the thing we're talking about today is totally not make-believe.
That is true, because
they make make-believe.
They make make-believe, yep. Exactly. Well, Finding Dory is imminently on the horizon, and we thought, well, we could talk about all of that, but that would just be basically telling you about Finding Nemo.
Yeah, the Finding Dory, like the Dory Geek History Lesson would just be like, and this happened in Finding Nemo. And people would be like, we could have just watched the movie.
So instead, I was like, let me take on the monumental task of telling you the entire history of Pixar, because they've really changed the landscape in popular culture.
Mm-hmm. And we think that they are a fascinating enough company that you can talk about their nonfiction history, and it should be kind of interesting.
I thought it was very interesting.
Well,
so
I hope me and our listeners feel the same way.
So do I.
Sorry.
So do I.
Let's jump into, this is a nonfiction podcast. I'm not certain how to take this. Is there a Tencent origin?
There is.
Okay. So, all right, listeners, calm down.
It's not too strange.
Calm down just like me. It's not weird. Okay. The nonfiction geekish lessons are exactly the same. So let's jump into the Tencent origin of the company of Pixar, where we're going to give you the clip notes things that you need to talk about if you're at a stockholders meeting and you're talking about whether you want to buy some stock at Pixar.
Man, I was hoping it was going to be a Pixar cocktail party, because that'd be super cool.
Well, there are Pixar cocktail parties. I assume they're mostly in Disneyland, but I'm talking to our financial listeners.
Oh, our many, many angel investors.
Yes.
All right. So here is the Tencent origin of Pixar. They are, of course, an animation and production studio based out of Emeryville, California. For those who aren't as intimately familiar with California, that would be what we colloquially call NorCal, basically north of San Francisco. They are currently a subsidiary of the Walt Disney Corporation, and they were founded on February 3rd of 1986. And the founders are Edwin Catmull and Alvy Ray Smith. We'll be talking about them a lot in just a little bit.
Oh, Alvy.
It goes by Al. Their popular properties include Toy Story, The Incredibles, and Jason is wearing an incredible shirt.
I am wearing an incredible shirt for all our audio podcast listeners. But for our video people, you can totally see it. Yeah.
And Inside Out. So there is your Tencent origin.
Ashley
of
is not
Pixar.
Wearing an Inside Out shirt. She's wearing a Batman shirt.
I'm wearing a Batman shirt.
She's betraying Pixar.
I am. So let's move right into the next section of the podcast, our meet cute.
Yes, meet cute is a term that we stole from romantic comedies, where we tell you where we first encountered Pixar, or a Pixar movie, mm-hmm. I guess, in this case, or even heard of Pixar.
I feel like this is going to be kind of similar to our Game of Thrones ones, where it's just like, well, I just watched Game of Thrones, mm-hmm. or I just read Game of Thrones. But I first met cute Pixar when the Toy Story movie came out in 1995, because I was a tiny baby child and my family took me to see it.
Oh, really?
They did. And I was so taken with, this is really weird, with the romance between Woody and Bo Peep. Like, I so wanted them.
It's such a tiny part of the movie.
I know. But I was five. Okay. So I remember, afterward, we went to...
You liked cowboys, didn't you?
I did.
All right.
I always knew. So we went to the Toys R Us after, and my mom bought me a Woody toy, and I, like, harassed this probably teenage employee asking where the Bo Peep toy was, and she didn't know.
I don't think there was a Bo Peep toy.
There wasn't, and I was so crushed.
Has there ever been a Bo Peep toy?
I don't think so. If there has, can someone please send it to me at the Mind University?
Oh, ma'am.
But I have such a vivid memory of, like, going and trying to get that toy afterward, because...
You really wanted that Bo Peep?
I guess it was that meaningful to me.
All right.
So how about you? How did you meet cute Pixar?
I do remember that movie coming out, the very first Toy Story in 1995. Now, I did not see it in theaters.
Oh.
And I actually, the first Pixar movie that I saw in theaters actually was Toy Story 2.
some years later.
Yeah, some years later. Because I remember going to see Toy Story 2.
Mm-hmm.
I watched the rest of them on video, but I do remember the media hubbub around the time that the first Toy Story came out. Because,
oh, yeah, like what?
Well, there was a lot of coverage about how people thought this was the first computer-generated film. A lot of people thought that it was going to flop. There were news reports about how this would never work because people, like, it was 2D animation and that's all it was. And the news reporters and the critics were like, this will never catch on. And then it blew out of the water and went crazy.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody saw it coming, but I can remember, like I said, these dopey news reporters, like, like spraying kids with their lawn hose from their old people house.
Get
like,
off my lawn, Pixar.
Yeah, you don't, this, we don't like no computer generated animated stuff over here. You get out of here, you know. But that was like a conversation that was being had in 1995.
That's crazy.
Yeah, because people were like, well, it's just done with a computer. It takes no skill.
Oh, man, that is such a lie.
The fake internet that didn't
exist. Yeah, of course.
You know,
of course.
The AOL discs. That's what they were talking about. You know,
I think that's crazy because I was so young when it happened that it was just like, oh, we're going to go see this other movie. Like, you don't realize until you take a step away from it to do something like this how revolutionary it was.
And isn't it crazy that it's completely flipped?
This is the only way you see an animated movie now.
And I will say that the first Toy Story's animation, I saw, I think, 2 years ago, the original movie. It mostly holds up.
It mostly holds up.
Except for me, I found the dog.
Yeah, the dog looks really fake.
The dog looks really fake.
But it's because the toys, it doesn't bother you that they don't move the way organic beings move.
Toys.
But you're like, I know how a dog moves. A dog doesn't move like
that. Yeah, the dog looks kind of, I'm going to say it, pixely in a couple places.
Yeah, Sid's dog. Yeah,
yes. And Sid looks a little pixely in a couple places, too.
I actually have seen people at cons cosplay as Sid
with
the messed up toys. It's one of my favorite cosplays to see because you have to know it to get it.
You have to know that it's Sid. Yeah.
It's a deep cut.
All right, cool. Let's move on into History 101, the main meat of the lesson, where Ashley is going to open the doors wide of Pixar and show you. Well, basically, she's just going to show you the motherboard that makes Pixar. So, let's do this. Woo! Computer lessons.
So, remember when I told you that Pixar was founded in 1986?
Yes, that is canon in fact, and I already said it at 7 cocktail parties.
So we're actually going to start in 1974.
You are a liar.
Because that is the idea, like the grain that's going to grow into Pixar, that is their earliest origin.
Okay.
So the New York Institute of Technology, you might have heard of it. There was a dude working there named
NIT.
NIT. Well, it's actually abbreviated NYIT, so NIT.
Okay.
NIT? So you gotta say it's sort of Russian?
I didn't go to a fancy computer school. I'm sorry.
I didn't either. It's okay. So there was a dude working there, and his name was Alexander Schur, S-C-H-U-R-E. And he founded this thing called Computer Graphics Lab, which was really revolutionary for 1974. And he did own a traditional animation studio at the time, but he thought that computer-generated animation within the realm of 2D animation was going to be the way forward so that you didn't have to draw every single cell. So he foresaw the way that Disney was doing their 2D animation by the 1980s and 90s.
Mm-hmm.
So he hired a bunch of scientists and designers who were studying at the school with the goal of creating the world's first computer-generated animated movie.
Wow.
Fun fact.
In the 70s.
In the 70s, 74.
All right.
The first two people he hired were Edwin Catmull and Al Smith, the two founders of Pixar.
Oh.
His first two employees. And so this is where the founders of Pixar got their start. He poured an estimated $15 million into the computer graphics lab right off the bat in order to fuel the development of their technology. And he basically drove the New York Institute of Technology into immediate financial strife doing that. Now, $15 million is a huge amount of money by today's standpoint.
Yeah.
Imagine what that would have been in 74. Like, it probably would have been closer to $1 billion.
No. $15 million?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
that's what the research that I did said.
Said $1 billion?
It would be like investing $1 billion in this startup company now.
No. I mean, I could see how it'd be like $100 million.
There you go, $100 million.
But not a billion.
Well,
no.
The internet lied to me.
Okay.
They soon realized that their company was going to have to be converted into an actual film studio in order to achieve their goal. It couldn't just be a bunch of dudes in a room with some computers, which was kind of what it was at the New York Institute of Technology.
They were like, boys, we don't need to write a story. The computers will do it.
Yeah, I'm sure that's exactly what they were like. So, enter.
Hand me a tab. Fab Cola.
Enter George Lucas. Now, George Lucas, of course,
wait,
you're...
Wait, do that again.
Enter George Lucas.
Da, 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 da. Hello.
You're
hi,
right.
I am George Lucas.
I think that's your Bill Gates as well.
Well, we NorCal geniuses kind of sound the same. The power of myth tells us that the hero's journey leads to Pixar.
It also sounds a little bit like your Hickman. So, of course, George Lucas, everyone knows, creator of Star Wars. He offered all six employees working at the computer graphics lab jobs working at Lucasfilm.
What year was this? I'm sorry?
1977.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, 1975. It's the very next year.
Okay.
So these initial employees all quit the computer graphics lab over the course of a few months in order to keep Alexander Scherr from becoming really, really suspicious. So they basically all waited until they graduated and then quit and then went to work for Lucasfilm.
They were like, guys, he's bankrupting the school for us. Let's stab him in the back.
It was like if the Image Revolution happened really, really politely and quietly.
Yeah, really politely. Yeah, okay. Yeah, all right, yeah. All right.
So, of course, they were all hired into what was called the graphics group over at Lucasfilm.
Okay, cool.
And Ed Catmull.
I didn't know that Lucasfilm existed this early on.
Yes, it did. I don't know how long it had existed at this point or how public it was necessarily. Ed Catmull, founder of Pixar, was immediately put in charge of the graphics group. And fun fact, the Lucasfilm graphics group was one of the only three computer groups working for a production company in the world at that time.
Oh.
So this is cutting edge stuff.
Yeah, the other two groups were the Darknet guys.
Yeah, they were on whatever.
And one was Gary Gygax's Soldiers of the Darkness.
What?
That joke didn't work. I was trying to do a Dungeons & Dragons joke. I'll shut up now.
Okay.
Can you tell I didn't go to a computer school?
I can't because I didn't either. Al Smith was made the director of the graphics group, working directly under Ed Catmull, and this will kind of be their dynamic in everything going forward.
Okay.
Together, they founded what are now known as CG foundation techniques, many of which are still employed or heavily influence the current state of computer-generated graphics and images. This is stuff like pixels, particles, and vectors, and the way that you build an animation or a graphic from those things.
Okay, interesting.
Which is still jargon that you'll hear thrown around.
Yay.
They created a rendering program called Reyes, R-E-Y-E-S, which is the precursor to RenderMan, which is the proprietary Pixar technology that is slated to become open source in the fall,
which
actually.
Is really cool.
It is. As well as they created a few frames of an experimental short called The Works.
Okay.
You can find pictures of it online, but the actual rendering of the animation does not exist online.
Oh, so they've never like put it out in the short, because they've done a couple short film collection Blu-rays
and
DVDs.
We'll get to that.
Okay, so it's not in there.
No, but The Works was like less than 2 minutes of footage.
Okay.
So by 1982, the team was working with Industrial Light Magic, which is a very famous VFX company that you may have heard of.
Yep.
And they famously created things like the Genesis effect in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Which, by the way, I don't know if you're going to bring this up, the first use of CGI in any movie.
That's right.
It's the flyover shot of the Genesis planet in Wrath of Khan and what the Genesis device does to the planet. And apparently, do you have this quote of what George Lucas said when he saw it for the first time?
I don't.
Okay, so I learned this from the Wrath of Khan Blu-ray.
Okay.
They do this giant cool shot. Starts outside the planet, goes all the way to the water, and then pulls back out to the planet. And they showed it to George Lucas for the first time. And his comment apparently for this Blu-ray was, oh, nice camera move.
That's cool, though. That's such a huge compliment.
Yeah.
I would like to point out that about 15 minutes into this podcast, slightly less than that, we've touched on both Star Wars and Star Trek.
Ooh.
So good for Ashley.
The secret sauce.
They also created the stained glass knight in the Young Sherlock Holmes movie, which is terrible movie, but was a really cool effect for the time.
Yeah.
It has Brian Cox's terrible acting son. By this point, the team had expanded to 40 people from their original six. So in less than a decade, they have almost expanded 10. They've expanded about 8 times. Mm-hmm. So their growth is pretty exponential. By 1986, Ed Catmull and Al Smith take their 38 employees for a total of 40. They create Pixar and Incorporated along with George Lucas into a grown-up company.
Yay, so it's officially now Pixar.
It is. And okay. What was their reason for incorporating? Well, I'm so glad that you asked, Jason.
Hey, Ashley.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about tax code and corporation stuff.
Okay, we're actually going to get...
so interesting.
We're actually going to get into a lot of financial stuff, so strap in.
Okay, so if you've never been to computer school or financial school...
Welcome.
You're going to feel real dumb.
So I had to look all this up, so don't feel that bad.
Welcome to school, everybody.
So in 1983, George Lucas got divorced, and a lot of the revenue from Lucasfilm following the release of Return of the Jedi was kind of leaving, and everybody felt that they
to his ex-wife
that they would either be fired or their entire group would be axed or sold. So they incorporated Pixar to protect it from the profit loss.
So so it stopped from the divorce.
Yeah.
Wow. So George Lucas's wife owns the Ewoks.
Probably. I think that might explain something.
And Jabba the Hutt.
Their goal remained, of course, to complete the first computer animated feature film, but they knew that they would have to wait for computer technology to catch up with their needs, because they basically kept burning a couple down. They actually, there's records of them working computers so hard that they went up in flames.
Oh, that makes sense. And also, I think it was probably a hard goal because computers back in the 80s, kids, I don't know if you want to know this, computers were black screens with green text.
I like it when they got orange screens.
Yeah, yeah. And
they got hot.
It'd have been a real boring movie with only black and green as your two colors.
Well, I don't know. The Matrix did pretty well.
Well, that's true.
So as such, Pixar was originally created as a hardware company. They were not a creative company. And they were known as Pixar Image Computers because they sold Pixar Image Computers as their core product.
Okay.
And these were primarily sold to government agencies and researchers in the scientific and medical communities.
All right.
And if you go to the Pixar campus up in Emeryville, they have like three of them right in the lobby. I don't know if they still have everything inside, but they're at least the cases of the old computers, which is kind of cool.
And neither one of us has been to the Pixar campus.
No, but maybe people would have believed it if you hadn't said that.
Well, we got to be honest, Professor.
No, we haven't.
We haven't been there.
I bet one of our listeners has, though. So Steve Jobs of Apple fame was initially interested in investing in the project, but George Lucas found his offer to be too low, although he wound up accepting it in the end because nobody else wanted to invest in Pixar except Steve Jobs.
Really?
Yeah. So okay. At the time, Steve Jobs had just been fired from Apple Computers. So he's like ripe for a new project.
He's like, I need something.
Yeah. And so he wound up paying George Lucas $5 million for the technology rights, with an additional $5 million in cash going straight into the company. And for that, he was rewarded the position of chairman of Pixar's board of directors.
Ah, interesting.
So he became a very important dude.
Mm-hmm.
And fun fact, Walt Disney Studios was among those early consumers of Pixar Image Computers. And their machines were used as part of their computer animation production system, which was a digital paint and ink system used on their feature films in order to cut down the labor and hours required to make their movies. So this is right around your Beauty and the Beast, The Little Mermaid time, where they start incorporating computers.
Yeah, they started putting some CGI images into the 2D animation, like the ballroom from Beauty and the Beast.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Which is the same camera move as the one from Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty.
Yay!
Despite having
Except
much smoother looking. Yes. Despite having many wealthy clients, the Pixar Image Computers never sold very well.
Really?
Yeah. And in a bid to drive up sales, Pixar employee John Lasseter.
Oh, I know that guy.
Premiered his short film Luxo Jr. along with other samples at SIGGRAPH. SIGGRAPH is the computer graphic industry's largest convention, to insane fanfare because nobody had ever seen anything like it before. Luxo Jr. is on those collections of Pixar shorts. There's four of them.
Can I make a guess of which one this is?
Yes.
Is this the lamp?
It's the one with the two lamps and the ball.
Yeah.
That was a part of the Pixar logo then for a long time.
Which still is. The Pixar logo. The little lamp bouncing in the ball.
Yeah, that's Luxo Jr., which actually is going to tie into Jim Henson very shortly.
Jim Henson?
Yeah.
About what rough ballpark, what year are we at now?
88.
Okay, got it.
So despite the fanfare at SIGGRAPH, despite that everyone thought Luxo Jr. was the coolest thing that they'd seen since digital sliced bread.
A lamp!
Exactly. It was like Aladdin.
Which is better, Aladdin or a lamp? I think the lamp.
Pixar's computer sales were still very lackluster, and they were frequently flirting with bankruptcy.
This is
going to be a continue. I mentioned bankruptcy twice now. This is going to be a continuing theme for Pixar until very recently. As a result of this, Steve Jobs had to invest more and more money in exchange for greater and greater stock, because they're like, well, you're already chairman of the board. We're just going to give you more stock.
Maybe you should be all 12 positions of the board.
Yeah.
We'll give you 12 chairs.
Until he eventually amassed total ownership of Pixar.
Really?
Having invested $50 million by 1988. Which, again, folks, for the 80s, a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money now.
I mean, I want $50 million. Yeah. So by 1989, John Lasseter's animation department was converted into a division for producing computer animated commercials for outside companies in a bid to bring in more money. Some of these early clients included Tropicana, Listerine, and Lifesavers. So, like, you know, there was a commercial from the really early 90s where a Lifesaver pack rips open and all the little Lifesavers roll out. Those are all Pixar animated. Maybe Lifesavers.
I mean, that seems like every Lifesaver commercial.
Pixar
to me.
Did all of them.
Okay.
Like throughout the 90s.
Lifesaver's been just stealing from Pixar for years.
For years.
Okay.
So in April of 1990, I'm finally alive in this timeline. Pixar sold its hardware division, including all proprietary technology and imaging software, to Viacom Systems.
Uh-oh.
Which is a big tech conglomerate. They own a bunch of stuff. As well as transferring 18 of Pixar's only 100 employees to the same company. So they're beginning to downsize. They've only been a company for 4 years, and they're already just hacking it off of the bone.
Yep.
So during this time, Pixar underwent their first big company move from San Rafael, California to Richmond, California. For those interested, that is a 21-minute drive across the San Francisco Bay from where they were before.
Oh, man, so hard.
It's from like one place outside of San Francisco to another. It was pretty minor. This also marked the beginning of Pixar's dedication to using open source and open sourcing their software in order to encourage a growth in the industry standards, with RenderMan, Tapestry, and Adobe AdDepth available for Mac and Windows by the early 1990s.
Mm.
And because computers and technology and the internet was still really new by then, to make a professional product like that open source was still a huge deal.
Yeah.
So they're the ones who kind of started the idea of that, because if you make this thing that is, you know, quote, perfect, and you give it to everyone else, and then everyone is perfect, it's better because the quality of product you're creating is better.
Well, everybody raises up. Everybody raises. And that's the idea behind what they're doing now. Mm-hmm. They're opening the source because they're hoping that, I mean, I don't mean this term in a derogatory way at all. An amateur shows them how to use it right.
Well, and then if they're hiring people who are already familiar with their programs, that's less training on their end as well.
Yes. Yeah. But again, it'll open it up because somebody out there will do something with that program that Pixar would have never thought of.
Exactly. It's actually a really bold strategy that I think Pixar was wise in choosing. So we're now at the beginning of 1991, and Pixar is having major layoffs because they're still making no money, including laying off the company president, a man named Chuck Kolstad, and reducing their employee base to 42 people.
Lesson to be learned there, people. Lifesaver money don't help.
Well, John Lasseter didn't get fired, so maybe it did. And let me remind you that when they were first incorporated, there were only 38 employees. So for them, only 5 years later to have 42 employees is kind of sad.
They're still running kind of lean.
They are. However, that same year, they struck an historic deal with Walt Disney worth $26 million for Disney to produce 3 feature-length animated movies. The first of which was, of course, Toy Story. And at the same time, John Lasseter's animation department premiered their 4 Luxo Jr. shorts on Sesame Street, making them the first. Yeah. That was the first time they were ever shown to the world, and that was the first time television had fully CGI shorts shown.
I had no idea they were on Sesame Street.
I didn't either.
That was really cool. Yeah.
And like really cool that Sesame Street was the company or you know, the show that was like, yeah, man, like we can do that.
You know, public source. These lamps. We like them. We like these lamps.
We love lamp.
Mm-hmm.
So this department was all that remained of Pixar by this time, with everything else now owned by the Walt Disney Corporation.
All right.
That was the way that deal worked. And despite the fact that Pixar kept winning deals worth millions of dollars, they continued to be in financial strife. Until, in 1994, Steve Jobs almost sold the company to Microsoft, of all places.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only after the New York critics decided that Toy Story would probably be a hit. It reviewed so well, and it was agreed that Disney would distribute it in time for Christmas to hit that market the next year, that he decided not to sell the company. But Jobs took this opportunity to take a more active role in the company, and he made himself the CEO in addition to being chairman of the board.
Yep. See, he's going to get all 12 of those chairs.
That's true.
Yeah.
And you know who's the CEO here at the Mind University?
Kermit the Frog.
I wish. It's actually Professor Jason and I. And if you want to keep us from having somebody come and buy up the majority shares and being the chairman of the board and usurping us, then I would suggest heading on over to patreon.com/Jawin, J-A-W-I-I-N, and helping support us as we do this important research for you. For $3 a month, you get this a day early. And for $5 a month, you get the Geek History Lesson Extra podcast, where today we are talking about our favorite Pixar movie.
We're going to rank the Pixar movies.
Yes, from best to least best.
Yep.
So thank you to everyone who has donated at patreon.com/Jawin so far. You are the best. You are keeping our various lamps on, and we love you so much for it.
And we have had offers from Steve Jobs in the afterlife.
I mean, we're looking for investors all over the place. We're not picky.
He's told us that he wants all 12 chairs. He wants all 12 of our chairs.
And we were like, oh, we got to get 10 more chairs.
Yeah, we got to buy 10 more chairs.
So help us out with purchasing 10 more chairs.
Mm-hmm.
So then Toy Story, of course, went on to gross $362 million worldwide from an initial budget of $30
million.
So
huge.
That's about as successful as you can get.
It's huge.
And as a result, when Pixar held its IPO, which is an initial public offering, which is a stock market launch of a public offering in which shares of a company are sold to international investors like banks, hedge funds, etc. They held this on November 29th of 1995, and it beat Netscape as the biggest IPO of that year.
Netscape.
I know, right?
Oh, man. Where's that company?
And following half an hour of trading, Pixar stocks went from $22 to $45 a pop, which is a pretty exponential, impossible growth to
do. They still do pretty well.
Yeah, if you want to invest in something that you feel like is very low risk, Pixar or Disney would be a great way to start.
Yeah, exactly.
As a result of the success of Toy Story, Pixar underwent their second and last significant move to Emeryville, California, which is where they are based presently. And fun fact, that campus was designed by PWP Landscape Architecture, that famously designed the Alice in Wonderland statues that are currently in Central Park in New York City.
Okay.
And, you know, they're based on the illustrations from the Lewis Carroll book.
Got it.
And it opened in 2000.
All right.
So following this success, Pixar released A Bug's Life in 1998, Toy Story 2 in 1999, Monsters, Inc. in 2000, Finding Nemo in 2003, The Incredibles in 2004. Throughout the 90s and the early 2000s, the Pixar Brain Trust was developed.
Okay.
Well, what's the Pixar Brain Trust?
What's the Pixar Brain Trust?
I will tell. Do you know what the Pixar Brain Trust is?
Well, I know what a brain trust is.
Yeah, but do you know what the Pixar Brain Trust is?
Okay. Well, a brain trust is a bunch of people, smart people, that get together and they come up with ideas. So if that's not what the Pixar Brain Trust is, then I'm going to assume it involves puppets and strange magic.
You're almost correct.
Okay.
It is the studio's primary creative development process.
I was close.
You are close. Basically, what it breaks down to is directors, writers, and lead storyboard artists view each other's projects on a regular basis in order to offer up notes and constructive criticisms. The idea being that Pixar operates under the idea of being a filmmaker-driven studio that functions on the idea of peer review as opposed to the traditional Hollywood studio model of an executive-driven studio. It's supposed to encourage greater growth and creativity among your creators.
Yes, I've heard some podcasts talking about this where... and this is a thing that was like John Lasseter has now brought to Disney.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about that.
Where
they, it wasn't easy to do.
They will develop a story for 4 years.
Minimum. The Good Dinosaur was in development for upward of 6 years.
Yeah, and they will not. And they'll just keep drawing in storyboards, and they will not actually start animating the movie until they think they have that story solid, which I think goes to show why Pixar movies most of the time stand above the rest, because their stories are just solid.
Yes, and we'll touch on that a little more in the discussion session.
Okay.
So according to founder Al Smith, the Brain Trust is derivative of the relationship between Lasseter, Stanton, Dr. Unkirk, and Rampt, who were all leads on Toy Story.
One of them is called Doctor?
That's his last name.
Okay.
Yeah, I know.
I wanted to make sure I didn't mishear
it's
you.
It's the Doctor. Okay. It was 11.
Okay. The 11th Doctor helped make Toy Story.
Well, he seems like a good fit, right?
Okay.
So it works so well in Toy Story, so they were basically like, let's just, rinse and repeat.
Yeah, right.
So following Toy Story 2, Disney and Pixar find themselves at odds.
Uh-oh.
Because Disney originally wanted this to be a straight-to-DVD release and therefore not covered under their initial three-picture deal.
Oh.
Pixar came back and demanded that it be counted toward the three-picture deal, and it was eventually upgraded to theatrical release, although Disney refused to honor Toy Story 2 under the terms of that original contract. Because they're an evil corporation.
Yes, maybe.
Pixar went on to claim that the distribution of profits was not equitable between themselves and Disney, and since Disney was basically only distributing it, it ought to be. There were no initial clauses for sequels or derivative works or rights, which is looked at, you know, in reflection as one of Pixar's greatest oversights in the early days of their success.
Kind of a mistake.
But I don't think they ever knew that they were going to be making sequels.
You know, but it's one piece of advice, and I would give to anybody out there in any kind of creative endeavor.
In Denver.
In Denver, especially if you're in Denver, you need to listen to this podcast. You need to be prepared for any and every
eventuality.
Eventuality, excuse me. God, man.
You need the rights to everything in perpetuity forever.
Yes, because the internet has proved. I mean, 5 years ago, who would have ever thought that streaming services would have been the way media is being served right now?
Exactly.
And every
most contracts aren't covered under that.
Exactly. So you have to have that in perpetuity no matter what. And if you're a movie studio and you don't cover sequels, like, I have no sympathy for you.
No, I don't either. But to be fair, that was also right before we got into this age of sequels that we're in, this age of apocalypse of sequels that we're in right now.
That's true. But you, in the 90s, you can't. You really can't claim to be like, sequels, because there have been plenty of sequels by the time
of
the 90s.
You're right.
Like, I mean, we're that around that time, Jurassic Park 2, that we are on the third Batman movie.
Well, the Harry Potter series is coming out.
The Harry Potter series is still, I think, like four or five years away.
But this discussion was happening in 2003.
There were plenty of sequels around that somebody should have had that thought.
Yes. So by January of 2004, both companies had failed to reach a new agreement or draft a new contract between them. Excuse me, with Pixar intending to control production and own the resulting film properties themselves. They wanted to relegate Disney to strictly the distribution roles, financing and retaining 100% of their own film profits. So the next movies that came out were The Incredibles and Cars. They're being in development at this time. That was a great sentence. Uh-huh. And they were subject to this great debate that was going on. So Pixar eventually severed their agreement with Disney. And severed. And Disney founded Circle 7 Animation, which is an animation division that was speedily resolved in less than 3 years. And Steve Jobs was seeking...
They did a dog movie, that Bolt movie, I think.
Yeah, they did.
The dog movie, as I call it.
with Steve Jobs seeking partners other than Disney, although it appears that nothing ever really came out of that, save a brief flirtation with Warner Brothers that really quickly fell through.
Okay, got it.
So Pixar was almost owned by Warner Brothers.
That would have been...
Weird.
You know what, though? CGI Iron Giant 2.
Oh, man.
Throwing it out there.
CGI Batman.
We could have saw that.
Negotiations resumed between the two entities in September of 2005. So prior to this, Steve Jobs announced that Pixar would no longer be releasing their films on the Disney-dictated November-only schedule. Disney was like, yo, you can only release your movies in November. Rather, that they wanted to seek summer blockbuster release dates, allowing Pixar to release the DVDs during the holiday shopping season.
I remember that. I remember when
it was a big deal.
Pixar movies used to be the Thanksgiving movies.
Yeah.
They would always be the Thanksgiving movies. But now they seem to do that. Well, they'll have one in the summer and then one at Thanksgiving.
Well, because now they're doubling down on them.
Yep.
In 2006, an agreement was reached for Disney to buy Pixar for $7.4 billion.
$1 billion.
In an all-stock deal, which is the acquiring company essentially uses its own stock as cash to purchase the business.
Oh.
So if you're a stockholder, then you will receive Disney stock instead of Pixar stock.
I don't know about that's a good deal, but...
Well, let me tell you about whether or not it was.
Uh-oh, you know.
I do. So
welcome
this,
to the Geek History Lesson Business Report.
Yeah, you're welcome. This was approved by Pixar stockholders and completed on May 5th, 2006. And at the time, Steve Jobs was still the majority shareholder at 50.1%, and that transferred to 7% Disney stock and a seat on their board of directors. This put his holding in excess of CEO Michael Eisner's, who only owned 1.7% of the company.
I'm actually going to look up what Pixar stock is worth right now. I'm very curious.
I don't know if it's not just Disney stock anymore.
Oh, well, we're going to find out.
So as a part of the same deal, John Lasseter became the chief creative officer of both Pixar and Walt Disney Animation Studios, which included the Disney Toon Studios division, which is their TV animation division, as well as the principal creative advisor at Walt Disney Imagineering, who are the designers of the Disney theme parks. Ed Catmull, who was one of the Pixar founders, remained the president of Pixar, as well as becoming the president of Walt Disney Animation Studios.
Okay.
And John Lasseter has gone on to reveal that Robert Iger realized that Disney needed to acquire Pixar while watching the Hong Kong Disneyland opening parade. And he realized that Disney had not created a new character in the past decade, and they were all Pixar creations that everybody loved.
They were, because it was like Buzz and Woody and the ant and stuff like that. You are correct. There is no Pixar stock anymore. It is only Walt Disney, and Walt Disney right now is trending around an average of $100.
So, not unaffordable, but not cheap.
Yeah.
So, maybe we should buy Disney stock.
Maybe we should. I don't know.
Despite this deal and the shift of creative oversights, Disney and Pixar do remain separate studios, and clauses are in place to ensure that Pixar remains free and unmerged with Disney.
Free and unmerged.
And fun fact, Cars was the first movie to bear the Disney-Pixar shared logo.
Oh, yeah. Okay, cool.
So, following the release of WALL-E in 2008...
WALL-E.
Producer Jim Morris became the general manager of Pixar, which was a position created specifically for him.
Oh, good going, man.
Yeah. And he took charge of the day-to-day running of studio facilities and products. So he, if you go to the campus in Emeryville, he's the man on scene with the big office at the top in the corner, who's responsible for any and all crises that take place and all operations. And so a few years into the acquisition, John Lasseter and Ed Catmull were able to transfer the Pixar brain trust to Disney, and it is now referred to as the Disney Story Trust.
Ah, the Disney Story Trust. Nice. Well done, John Lasseter.
Yes, and it has been said by people who worked both in the Pixar Brain Trust and the Disney Story Trust that the Disney version is a much more polite version, and that at Pixar they often got very harsh and hurtful critiques.
Oh, okay.
Which I think is sort of interesting.
That is interesting. And it's also interesting, too, because I know in the past John Lasseter had been fired by Disney.
Yeah, he was.
And now he runs and is responsible for the success of Disney.
Yeah, it's sort of deliciously ironic.
It just shows you, kids, hold to your dreams.
Yeah, and be good at what you do.
Yep.
In 2010, so we're well into our modern age, Pixar expanded and incorporated Pixar Canada, based in Vancouver, British Columbia, with the focus on them being to create the short films that appeared before Cars and Toy Story 3. Although, sadly, it closed in October of 2013.
No.
With the idea of focusing more efforts on the Pixar California studios. They wanted everyone a little closer to home.
Okay, I sort of understand that.
Yeah, Pixar is very proud of not mining out any of their animation, which is a big trend in the industry right now. They do all of it on site in California.
Well, because it's a big trend now right now because there are so many shots of CGI in modern action movies now that if you go see something like Captain America Civil War, there are like 10 companies, special effects houses in the credits because
they're all working on one scene.
Yeah, because you cannot give it to Industrial Light and Magic anymore and have them cover the entire movie. No.
I mean, not with their aggressive release schedule.
Yes, and I also think that that's responsible for why CGI now in a lot of major big budget movies looks real wonky.
Real rubbery.
Because they're not all held to the same quality standard like Pixar would be.
Right, and they should be. And also to this day, Pixar still sound mixes and records all of their sound on the Lucas Ranch, on Skywalker Ranch.
Yeah, it's Skywalker Sound.
Because why not? And because everybody else in the world does
that. Well, it's the best. There's a reason why you use it.
Yes. So following the partnering with Disney Studios, the following movies were released under the Pixar imprint. Cars in 2006, Ratatouille in 2007, WALL-E in 2008, Up in 2009, Toy Story 3 in 2010, Cars 2 in 2011, Brave, my favorite movie, in 2012, Monsters University in 2013, Inside Out in 2015, The Good Dinosaur in 2015, and we're right about to hit Finding Dory in 2016. So if you look at those dates, and I know that I'm the only person who has them right in front of her, but they're becoming more prolific and they're getting movies out. We had two in the same year last year because the Disney machine has been able to pump a lot of money and resources into Pixar.
That's what Disney does, man. They get a brand and then they like pump so much water through it until it dries up.
I mean, look at the Marvel release schedule.
Yep.
And then in 2014, Jim Morris, that little producer from WALL-E, was promoted to the president of Pixar.
Yes.
And that's about as current as you can be up to what's going to happen with Finding Dory here in the next couple days on the history of Pixar.
That was pretty fascinating. Who knew that Pixar was like a low-rent Radio Shack for like most of the 90s?
It kind of was.
They're
isn't
like,
that crazy?
Will you buy our computers?
So that we can fund making the computers that we actually want to use.
Please. We want to make a movie. Then be a movie company. No, we want to sell computers.
Yeah. So let's move into the next part of the podcast, which is the recommended reading.
Okay, the recommended reading. You can go to geekhistorylesson.com/recommended reading. You can find all the stuff that we recommend. You'll see a little picture of it. You can click on it. It'll take you to Amazon. And if you buy that book through that link, a little bit of that purchase will come back our way. It helps keep the Mind University on, helps us build this awesome table that we now use to record Geek History Lesson on, that you can see on the videos we do, and
it helps keep us in lamps.
It just helps the Luxors,
the Luxos, L-U-X-O, Luxo.
I almost call it Luxor, like in Las Vegas. The Luxos brighten our day.
Yes, they do.
There you go.
So I'm going to recommend a bunch of things, but I'm going to do it for you very simply. Pixar puts out an art book for every single feature length movie that they do, and most of their shorts. They're a really beautiful look at everything in the process of developing those books, from the sketches up into the final renders. I'm going to have a list of my favorites and Jason's favorites up on recommended reading for you, which you can find at geekhistorylesson.com/recommended reading.
It'll be like five. It won't be like all 15.
No. Okay. But that's what it's going to be. Okay. And if those are movies that are not your favorites, you can navigate from those pages and you can find your favorites.
Oh, very simple. And now we move on into the discussion.
Yes. So we talked a little bit before about the Pixar Brain Trust, and we started to think about why it was effective. So I thought that we could talk a little bit about why we think that peer review kind of way of working inside a studio system is effective, and how that's transferred and changed now that it's over at Disney.
You know, for a second there, I thought you were going to be like, Jason, I hate to tell you, we are now instituting a Geek History Lesson Brain Trust, and you no longer have a majority 50% share. You're more like 22.
I don't know. Do you? 50% isn't. It's got to be 50.1%.
Why is it got to be 50.1?
Because that's majority. Because 50 is not majority. It's...
No, I'm saying we. I don't have majority over you.
I was going to say you don't.
No. I said 50.
Okay.
So yeah, I have 50. You have 50.
Yeah.
Are you saying you want the 0.1? Is that what you're saying? Are you instituting the Geek History Lesson coup right now? I don't know it.
I don't want the 0.1 because you do more work than me. But yeah, do you think that the way Pixar movies look now that they're Disney movies are different? And do you think that is an effect of the way that their creative process is?
They don't look different. You talking about like the animation, they don't.
No, I mean like the feel or kind of the way that the story is told, anything
Man, I don't know. That's a tough question. I think there is a change.
I think they're more polished.
Really? You think they're better?
Not, I don't mean that in a better way, but you know, like, you can see the same change in the Marvel movies. The Marvel movies in Phase 2 kind of look like somebody took a cloth and cleaned them.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's the same with the Pixar movies post-Cars, which was post the merger. They kind of look like someone took a cloth and, like, wiped any edges away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't that there was anything particularly wrong with either of those before. I just think that it's more money, which affords more time and better technology.
I don't know. See, but I like edges and I like mistakes and stuff like that, because I actually really like A Bug's Life.
Do you?
And I know a lot of people don't, but I actually didn't see that movie until I was like older.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go back and watch that movie, and again, this is me saying not having seen it for like 5 years now. But I remember when I saw it, like, it has such an amazing score, and it's kind of a movie that's all about like, I can do this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody being like, no, you can't, idiot. And he, and the main character just being like, yeah, I can. And he just never gives up.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of BS's his way to gather that army of bugs to go help him fight the grasshoppers.
Yeah.
And they sort of beat the Kevin Spacey grasshopper.
They do it.
And it's kind of a weird movie. Like, it doesn't have the traditional kind of like storyline.
It doesn't have the traditional feel good that Pixar movies do.
Well, because he loses.
Yeah.
Like, spoilers, he loses.
But he proves that he can do it.
he only wins because he convinces the other bugs, the other ants, to follow him. They see his example, mm-hmm. and then they're like, no, this guy is actually talking sense. And that's the reason why they beat the grasshoppers.
Yeah.
And that's a never would have been made as a Disney movie, because it's very like, it's very almost like, I want to say hippie.
Sure. And very I know what you mean,
like,
though.
NorCal, like, we can do it, man.
Yeah, totally. You don't have to say this because we'll address it in the Geek History Lesson Extra, but is your favorite movie pre or post Disney merger?
Where did the Disney merger happen?
Cars in 2005.
It's pre.
Okay, because mine is post, and I think that's kind of interesting.
Mine is pre. I don't know. I do think that before the merger, we would have had less sequels.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I think the movies would have been less aggressive, because the Pixar schedule used to be a lot slower. It wasn't even at once a year. Sometimes.
Yeah.
Very early on, it wasn't. It was like every 2 years.
Yep.
Yeah.
Every year and a half or 2 years. Yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't every year. And now it's twice a year.
I mean, some of that is the technology, too. You can render that stuff a lot faster.
Sure. And some of that's like more budget, mm-hmm. more employees, mm-hmm. stuff like that. But I think now, because Pixar used to have an unbroken record for me.
Yes.
They used to have it used to be every Pixar movie was gold,
mm-hmm.
and you couldn't touch it. And I think they broke that. I think they broke that after what happened after Cars?
Ratatouille.
Yes, that's where it broke.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I like Ratatouille, but Ratatouille broke it, because Ratatouille to me is not a perfect movie.
Yeah, because the merger goes Cars, Ratatouille. Which I would say that I like Ratatouille more than Cars personally.
And then
you get Wall-E and Up. Wall-E, Up, and Toy Story 3 right in a row.
Ooh, I don't... Okay. What's after Toy Story 3?
Cars 2, Brave, Monsters U, Inside Out, Good Dinosaur.
Okay, I'll tell you what. All right. I'll let that go all the way to Toy Story 2. I'll let that go to Toy Story 3.
Yeah.
But there are some problems...
There are weaklings after the merger. Yes,
agreed.
Yes.
They're still pretty strong,
mm-hmm.
But Cars 2, I think everybody can agree, is the worst Pixar movie ever.
I would say easily, yeah.
Like, no doubt.
Yeah.
And it's one of those movies where you're like, what are you thinking? Why did you make this movie? But Cars, I think, it's weird. I have some love for the weird Pixar movies, because Cars gets a bad rap. Again, and I had no desire to see Cars.
I think you should share this, because you convinced me on Cars.
Yes. I took my little brother to see this movie at a cheap theater in Tulsa, Oklahoma,
and
for $3.
And about how old was he at the time?
Oh, I don't know.
Under 10?
Under 10. Okay. Yeah. He was somewhere between 5 and 10, I think.
Okay.
Closer to 5.
Okay.
Very young. And I know he listens to these podcasts. So hello, my little brother. let's see if you remember this. And he wanted to go see it. I had no desire to go see it, but I went and saw it with him,
mm-hmm.
and I took him to see it, and he loved it. And to be honest with you, over the course of the movie, I loved it too. By the time the movie stopped, I mm-hmm. loved it. And if you look at that movie, it is the perfect representation of Route 66,
mm-hmm.
and what Route 66 means to America. And the sad thing about that is that none of that was in the advertising.
Right.
And when you watch that movie, you're like, again, and it's a little bit subversive, just like Bug's Life. It doesn't have a clear plot to it. Whereas like that movie is about the main character being like, oh yeah, having these modern conveniences like the internet and cell phones kind of hurts us sometimes,
mm-hmm.
and kind of makes us forget, you know, it's very existential, you know, which is very different for a kid's movie.
Definitely.
And I've actually, I've done part of the drive on Route 66 through America,
mm-hmm.
and I've had people on Route 66 tell me that the Cars movie means a lot to them.
Really?
Because it represents Route 66, which is kind of dying off.
It is. It's a nostalgia thing now.
But yeah, like I don't see Pixar making the existential emotion movies anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They don't do it anymore. They just don't. And that's a risk. And I think that's what makes those movies connect so much. I'm talking a lot. I'm sorry. What do you think?
I just think it's really interesting that
Do you see a difference?
I do. Like I said, I talked kind of about the sheen, which is this ephemeral thing that I can't quite describe perfectly. But I think it's very fascinating that post post-merger, you see Disney's CG animated movies have started to do...
Got better. Yeah.
A lot better. Like Tangled was very successful, Big Hero 6, and then Frozen is like the biggest thing since Cinderella.
And everybody's loving Zootopia.
Everyone's loving Zootopia. Yep. So I think it's interesting that those are also not Pixar movies. Like,
but it's awesome, too, because I think it's made their main animation company step up. We were talking about it earlier.
Yeah, their standard has risen.
You got to step up. DreamWorks has done the same thing. Mm-hmm. I think DreamWorks, I mean, yeah, they still make those dumb Minions movies, but...
Yeah, but DreamWorks also gave us Kung Fu Panda.
Yes, and
Shrek, and which the first one was good.
Kung Fu Panda 1 is good.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so, like, those... It's made everybody step up.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if anyone... can touch Pixar?
No.
I think for me personally,
that's not to say they're not infallible.
No. No, but if you're looking at their body of work,
yes.
But for me, I think Big Hero 6 as a film gets very close.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Pixar is still very much the reigning king and or queen.
Well, I will say that animation students over the next 50 years will definitely always look at the first 10 years of Pixar.
Oh yeah,
without a doubt. Like, they will study that period intensively because there are some amazing films in there that will be remembered in the pantheon next.
I mean, Toy Story.
Well, I was going to say next to, yeah, Toy Story will be in the pantheon next to Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Oh, yeah.
Forever.
Utterly, yeah.
No doubt.
Completely.
So.
Great. Well, that'll about wrap up my discussion. So why don't we move on to the final part of our podcast?
The final part of the podcast is the teaching tweet, where Professor Ashley will use her computer, because we are at computer school, and in 140 characters right. or less, she will type in computer code a tweet about her thoughts on the history of Pixar. Now, I'm very interested in this teaching tweet. The first teaching tweet on Geek History Lesson about a nonfiction subject.
It's true.
So let's see what this is.
Hashtag Pixar, ... What more do you need me to say?
Very simple. Okay. But notice, she went existential.
Like early Pixar movies.
You got to put your meaning on that one. So just throwing it out there.
There you go.
Let's... You need to study that for 10 years, that teaching tweet, and figure it out.
And in 10 years, I'll let you know what I've discovered in my 10 well, years
say,
from now.
I was saying the listeners, you don't have to do it.
Oh, okay.
You're the professor. Screw them. Got homework now.
Yeah, do your homework.
Well, cool. I think that was a very interesting nonfiction. We've had some requests for some interesting nonfiction. Mm-hmm. Couple subjects that we like, couple subjects that we were like, there's no way we can do that. I know we came up with Pixar ourselves because the new movie, Finding Dory, and I think we pulled it off. So maybe this could open up a brand new avenue for Geek History Lesson, that nonfiction subjects
are now open.
Are now so, open into the school.
Get your suggestions in.
Within reason, as long as they have a geeky twist.
Right.
So, Ashley, if they want to suggest ideas for a future nonfiction Geek History Lesson, what should they pick?
What should they pick?
Or where should they... What should they pick? Yeah, yeah. I want to hear. We're going to do that. What should they pick? And then where should they tell you and tell us to do them?
They should pick the production history of Star Trek, because I think that'd be really interesting to do.
Mm-hmm.
And they should tell us over on facebook.com/geekhistorylesson. There's a bunch of ways to contact us there, and at geekhistorylesson.com, where there's a bunch of different ways to contact us there.
Guys, don't forget, you can listen to this podcast every week on iTunes, Stitcher, and SoundCloud, and head on over there and give us an iTunes review, because we started reading some of them on the air and we like hearing all your stuff. But you remember how I said every week Geek History Lesson's going to happen? Well, I have some disappointing news.
Aww.
There will be no Geek History Lesson podcast next week.
It's summer reading week. Get your recommended reading.
That's right. We're going to take a week off, enjoy some rays of sunshine, maybe on the Pixar campus or some random forest that we decide to call the Pixar campus.
Probably that.
Wherever we decide to set up our lawn chairs. So next week, you'll have to console yourself with any of our recommended reading, which you can find at geekhistorylesson.com/recommended reading, or just go back and listen to our archives. We have 118 episodes of fun stuff for you to listen to.
Which one do you think they should listen to?
Oh, man, I don't know.
No pressure.
I liked Apocalypse. That was a recent one that we did. I love I will always have a fondness for Nightwing.
I think Nightwing and Hawkeye are two of our best, personally.
Hawkeye is the introduction to West Coast Avengers. but you know what? Another fun one that would be, go way, way, way back into the original, like, 20 episodes. Go listen to Professor X.
Oh, that was a good one.
Yeah, that's a really good one. So there you go. Plenty of summer archive listening. And you can tell us what old episodes of Geek History Lesson you like the most on my Twitter at Jawin, J-A-W-I-I-N, and on Ashley's Twitter at Ashley V. Robinson. I have been Jason. I'm still trying to sell computers since the 80s, Inman.
I have been Ashley Victoria Robinson.
And Professor Ashley, who took us to business school, computer school, and every kind of existential school.
Oh,
please dismiss and confound our students as we close out the podcast.
Class is now dismissed. Go render yourself some mans.
Get it? She said render. She means it both. You mean it both ways, right?
I do.
Wow.
You got to boil them so that the fat comes off them.
What does that mean? What does that mean? Say enter George Lucas.
Enter George Lucas.
Dun, 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 dun. Bye.